It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, sitting in for Renee Montagne. What a difference a year makes. Last October, people were writing articles predicting the great inflation of 2008 and 2009. People were forecasting that oil might hit $200 or $300 a barrel. Ethanol production was supposed to make corn prices go through the roof. And now? Well, oil is heading toward $50. Prices for everything from corn to soybeans to gold are falling. And economists are raising the specter of deflation, lower prices for everything. NPR economics correspondent Adam Davidson is here to tell us why this is something we should be worried about. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Ari.
Well, lower prices sound like a good thing. So what's the problem?
Yeah, this is a weird thing about deflation. I myself have to kind of remind myself why it is such an ugly, ugly thing. Because, of course, we spend all our lives hoping prices will go down and wanting everything we buy to be a little bit cheaper. So when everything is going down in price, that seems like a good thing. And it would be a good thing in the short run. But the problem is that eventually when prices are going down continuously and people predict that prices are going to go down in the future, they dramatically change their behavior. So let's say you were thinking of buying a car, you had the money to buy a car, but you notice cars were $1,000 cheaper every month. Well, you might say, well, I'm not going to buy one this month. Maybe I won't even buy one for 6 months. I'll just keep waiting for it to go down. The car company might say, well, we could build a factory this month for $100 million, but if we wait 6 months, it'll be $90 million. And basically what you see is everyone from the consumer to big businesses are putting off everything because there's no reason to spend money now if everything's going to be cheaper in the future. And that starts ending economic activity.
Sure, but it's hard for me to imagine that if I've decided I need a car or a computer or I'm a company that needs to build a factory that I'm just going to wait forever. If I need it, I'm going to buy it eventually, even if prices keep going down, right?
Right. And this is on a spectrum. So you know, you're going to buy something to eat today. You're not going to say, I'm going to put off eating for a few months and wait for food prices to go way down. But if you were thinking of starting a new food business, you might say, now's a lousy time. Why would I spend $1,000 making my, you know, cornmeal bread
when I can spend $900 down the road?
Right. Or spending $1,000 today, my product won't be ready for 2 months, and 2 months from now, I'll only be able to get $900, you know, back. So I can't, there's no way for me to make money in this deflationary environment. So there are things that would still happen, but there's an awful lot of stuff that simply doesn't get done in a deflationary spiral. It just doesn't happen. And innovation, new products, those are the kind of things that fuel this economy, and those are exactly the kind of things that stop happening.
What can the government do to help avoid a deflationary spiral or to stop one once it starts?
That's the big problem. When there's an inflationary crisis, like there was, say, in the late 70s, early 80s, the government can raise interest rates very high, and that slows economic growth and slows inflation. But when there's a deflationary spiral, there's a floor. The government can only lower interest rates to zero. It can't go to negative, and that means there just isn't as much they can do to get us out of deflation. It's a very hard cycle to break.
Okay, so this is a terrible thing that the government can't do much to stop. How scared should we be? Are we likely to enter a deflationary spiral, or is this kind of a far-off specter that we don't actually need to worry about?
There are certainly signs pointing to its possibility. What I will say is the government has a very hard time stopping it once it starts, but there are things the government can do to make it less likely for it to start. And that is the real focus of not only the U.S. government, but the European Central Bank, Asian central banks. There's a real effort to get the economy growing. But that, of course, means that, you know, 2 years, 4 years down the road, we might not have deflation, but we might have inflation, which might not be as bad, but isn't great either.
Okay, well, if we enter a deflationary spiral, will you just give us a call and let us know?
I will let you know, but I might wait a few weeks because I might want to buy a cheaper phone or use cheaper minutes.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Ari.
That's NPR's Adam Davidson, and you can find lots more about deflation and all sorts of other economic topics at our Planet Money website and blog. It's at npr.org/money.
Another plan to help homeowners comes from Sheila Bair. She leads the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The FDIC has been cleaning up after the failure of IndyMac Bank. And now Bair wants to rework the terms of millions of American mortgages the same way the FDIC changed many of IndyMac's mortgages.
We have been going through those systematically and restructuring them to provide an affordable payment First of all, everybody pretty much gets the same type of modification. We use a combination of interest rate reductions. If we can't get you an affordable payment that way, we will extend the amortization of your 30-year loan to 40 years.
Oh, which lowers the monthly payment.
Which lowers, and if we can't get there, then we will also forbear principal. We won't eliminate the principal.
They can put it off till later.
Well, it actually is permanently deferred unless you refinance or sell the house. And we've done this we've modified about 5,000 so far. We have several thousand more.
But what are you doing? What is it that you want to do for millions of mortgages?
Well, we'd like to use this protocol, and we're proposing some financial incentives to get this done. Specifically, we're proposing that if servicers modify a loan to this IndyMac protocol, the servicer will get $1,000 for each loan modification. And then if the loan is modified but it still defaults later on, the government will share up to half of the losses on that redefault. So we think we can get about 2.2 million loans modified. It would be at a cost of about $25 billion. We'd propose that the program last through 2009. The government is getting something in return for this, which is keeping these houses off the foreclosure rolls, because these escalating foreclosures is creating more and more downward pressure on home prices, which is having a very negative impact on our economy.
I just want to understand something here, though,
sure.
Because you're talking about now, if your proposal were accepted, renegotiating mortgages where somebody is spending about a third of their income on the mortgage every month. How on earth are you going to distinguish between the people who got in over their heads, were a little bit deceived by the person who sold them the loan, and those people who just made a conscious choice to buy a big house, and they're out there paying right now, and suddenly you're going to let them off the hook for part of their payment?
Right. Well, you know, I think, first of all, you'd have to be below the conforming loan limit, so it wouldn't, for the super expensive houses, this program would not be available. And yes, there may be some who knew that they had an unaffordable mortgage and took it anyway and got into that house, and you know what? Yes, you're right, they're going to be benefiting by this. But you know what else? Why take a punitive step of forcing them into foreclosure? You're going to have another empty house sitting on the neighborhood for over a year. Who does that help? I don't think that helps anyone.
Although there are going to be people who, they're making their payments every month, and they're going to say, why is my neighbor getting this break when he bought a house just like mine, but he's going for help and I'm not?
A couple of things. First of all, they're not going to get a break on their principal, okay? So there may be some forbearance on the principal. But they're still going to have to pay off that principal if they refinance or sell the house. Number two, these are people that got unaffordable mortgages. And what we're doing, we're just making the mortgage affordable. Neighbor.
Although, again, I can hear the complaint. I'm paying my affordable payment that I carefully structured, and now my tax money is paying for my neighbor's, you know, the third room in the house, whatever it is.
Well, I think that I would say to those neighbors, you know what? I haven't had any problems, but I want my neighbor's mortgage fixed because, yes, I do have some compassion for that person, but I also realize that it's in my economic self-interest to get the situation stabilized. This relentless procession of foreclosures is creating havoc with our housing market, and we need to get it stabilized.
One other thing, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, the guy who's got the money to spend,
right,
as you well know, has said this week, nice idea you have, but that is a spending program. That's giving away money, and Paulson doesn't see the bailout as giving away money. He sees it as investing by buying loans or buying stocks in companies. The taxpayers get to own something.
Right.
And that's why he doesn't think that your proposal fits the bailout.
Right. Well, we have a very constructive, we're still talking with Treasury, and I've got a great working relationship with Secretary Paulson, and I've been very supportive, but we do disagree with him on that point.
Is your proposal dead because Paulson said it's not a good idea?
Well, I don't think it's dead. I think we're still talking. I think he didn't close the door completely. And I think he's actually, in terms of the substance of the program, I think he's quite supportive. It's just where the money comes from is really the issue we're debating.
Sheila Bair, Chairman of the FDIC. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bair's proposal shows how the government bailout is still evolving. Last night on NPR's All Things Considered, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was asked what Americans are getting for the $300 billion committed so far.
I believe the banking system has been stabilized. No one is asking themselves anymore, is there some major institution that might fail and that we would not be able to do anything about it? So I think that is a positive. Let me tell you, it took a long time to build up these excesses. It's going to take a good while to work through this period.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who still has another $400 billion to spend.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, sitting in for Renee Montaigne. We're about to hear some of the competing proposals to help out people who can't pay their mortgages.
One plan comes from the woman whose agency insures your bank deposits, and we'll hear from her in a moment.
We begin with a warning from the U.S. Senate. Lawmakers told bankers that they should help out homeowners, and if the banks don't, bankruptcy judges might. Here's NPR's David Wellma.
At a table facing members of the Senate Banking Committee sat four senior executives from Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America. Together, their institutions have received in the last few weeks $85 billion in stock purchases from the financial bailout program. They also got a collective scolding from the committee's Democratic chairman, Christopher Dodd.
I think I speak for many of members of this committee and the Senate in saying that we want to see more progress from your friends in the financial sector. More progress in foreclosure mitigation, in affordable lending, and in curbing excessive compensation. And if that progress is not forthcoming, then we are prepared to legislate, now if possible, but next year if necessary.
Dodd said he may try in next week's lame duck session of the Senate to change bankruptcy laws so that homeowners can seek Chapter 13 protection for their primary residence if it's in danger of foreclosure. The Senate blocked such a move earlier this year, but Dodd appears emboldened by the half dozen or more seats that Senate Democrats added in last week's election.
The idea that you can go into bankruptcy court and protect your boat if you want to, your car, and your vacation home. You can do those. Those are all contracts. You can protect those in a bankruptcy court, but you can't protect your primary residence. I mean, there's something fundamentally false about that notion.
Joining Dodd's push for bankruptcy protection for primary residences was a witness who was not a banker. Nancy Zirkin of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights said the possibility of resorting to such protection would give homeowners much greater leverage renegotiating the terms of their troubled mortgages.
It doesn't use public funds, and more importantly, it would quickly help other homeowners in our economy by keeping the value of the surrounding homes from being eroded, stopping a vicious cycle that can only lead to more foreclosures.
But the idea of bankruptcy judges intervening in home foreclosures troubled Florida Republican Mel Martinez.
I know that it's appealing to think that a judge could just modify the mortgage. However, my lawyerly sense tells me that if you have a contract, then all of a sudden it's going to be dramatically modified by judicial fiat, that there may be something that investors might look askance at and may be a liquidity issue going forward in terms of mortgage money.
All four witnesses from the big banks said they oppose such court-dictated mortgage revisions, which are known in the industry as cramdowns. Wells Fargo's John Campbell warned that cramdowns would only increase uncertainty for financial investors.
Investors are going to require two things to happen to try and offset the uncertainties. One, down payment some will probably be increased, and logically, prices would be increased to try and offset some of the uncertainties that exist by contracts being able to be just crammed out.
A top Democratic leadership aide predicts in next week's lame duck session there's little chance Republicans will drop their opposition to changing the bankruptcy law to favor homeowners. With a bigger Democratic majority next year, though, it may be a different story. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
Hedge funds are also taking a big hit in this financial crisis. Investors are yanking their cash out of these private investment funds. And lawmakers want to tighten the regulations on hedge funds. Top players in the industry were on Capitol Hill yesterday trying to fend that off. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The $1.7 trillion hedge fund industry has been criticized for the role it's played in making the markets more volatile. Fund manager George Soros acknowledged that hedge funds were an integral part of the housing bubble that built up in recent years.
But the bubble has now burst, and hedge funds will be decimated. I would guess that the amount of money they manage will shrink between 50% and 75%.
Soros said now is not the time to crack down on hedge funds too much, and he urged Congress not to overreact by imposing ill-considered and punitive regulations on them. Several fund managers said they supported efforts to force the industry to become more transparent about its holdings. They said information about their assets could be released to regulators, but they said such information should be withheld from the public because their asset strategies would no longer be secret. Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings said the way hedge fund managers get paid is unfair. Much of the money they make is considered capital gains, which is taxed at a much lower rate than income. He said that means these five fund managers, who make on average more than $1 billion a year, pay less of their income in taxes than Joe the plumber. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.